Meeting of the Finance Committee to order. Before we start, I'd like to make a change to the proposed agenda and to remove the action item to be discussed next month. And with that change, would ask for a motion to approve the agenda.
Second.
Any objection? Hearing none, we'll go with that agenda. We also have minutes of the prior meeting.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. So without the action item, we'll just be moving to the two information items on the agenda. First up will be a report on our continued progress in addressing the recommendations from the FTA's Financial Management Oversight Report and our continuing work with the FTA on getting ourselves back into the regular cycle of making applications, getting grants approved, and getting reimbursements. I think there's a lot of progress. But the key item for today's agenda is for the General Manager and the CFO to present the proposed fiscal year 2016 operating and capital budgets. Leading up to this point, we've had a lot of insight into where we might be going. We've had our three-year rolling financial plan, which has been predicting over time where we'd be. We've had good discussions, including the preview last month, the forecasts of ridership and revenue, and our progress in moving the capital program. So that's all part of what we've done. The General Manager's proposed budget reflects all of this input, as well as reflecting response to last month's preview and the suggestion that it really needed to be tightened up, and there are some steps that have been taken there. But I think we all have to recognize that budgets are very stubborn things. You have to decide what you're going to do, you have to decide what that will cost, and you have to find a way that the revenues coming in support what you want to do and what it'll cost. So it's not as if there are any magic accounts that we can turn a dial and say, yeah, let's cut back by some percentage. It really does mean decisions will have to be made on one side of the ledger or the other. So beginning that discussion today is very timely. The budget will involve difficult choices, possibly even changes in levels of service, which I think we will talk about, some that have been proposed, some others that have been suggested. There are also within the presentation some things that would make sense over the long term to evaluate. They may not be doable in this budget cycle in a full amount, but they are worth looking at in terms of how the responsibilities and the costs for the services we provide are divided, and we would want to begin conversations with the jurisdictions about some of those things, hopefully in ways that can not only be financially beneficial, but potentially offer better service to the region and to our customers. So this is a significant step in the approval process for next year's budget, but I'm sure we will have many more conversations around this table over the next several months and with our jurisdictions before we are in a position to say we have a workable solution and we're ready to go forward. But it's among the more important things we have to do. Hiring general managers and approving budgets are what we're here to do. And at the moment, we're doing both of those. So I'm open to the conversation and to continuing to work with all of you towards the solutions that we need to find. But before we get into the budget, let me turn it over to staff to talk about the FMO process.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman and members of the committee. Our objective for this item today is to provide you the monthly progress status on Metro's committed corrective action plan items in response to the Federal Transit Administration's Financial Management Oversight Review Report. I'll tell you that today's report is going to be brief. This month's FMO dashboard reflects two updates since our last report to you. One is in the FMO compliance training area, and the other is in the manual draw submission quality area. And I'll go through each of these dashboard quadrant charts individually. Our CAPS completion status remains unchanged. We've completed 62 of 65 CAPS. They've been submitted to the FDA. Two have been requested to be extended, and one has a commitment due date in June of 2015. On the FMO compliance training graph, it reflects the participation of our first 10 employees attending the first asset management training course that was conducted on November 19th. With respect to the quality of our manual draw submissions, since last reporting on this, we received approval of two more draw packages that were submitted in late October. One was approved for 100% of the total dollar value and the other for 97%. The effect of these two approvals improved the cumulative success rate by one percentage point to a 96% rate of approval of the total cumulative dollar amounts of manual draw submissions since the imposition of the ECHO draw restriction in late March. And our final dashboard quadrant chart reflects the number of CAPS submitted against the 9 material weakness and significant deficiency findings, and the number of FMO report recommendations within those findings that our corrective action plan submissions have been deemed as by FDA as having been adequately fulfilled. Since the last FMO board update in November, we've not received any additional feedback on our corrective action plan follow-ups. Our summary timeline recaps the major milestone dates of corrective action plans submitted, the follow-up requests we've received, and the follow-up submissions we've provided, all since the final FMO report was issued in June of this year. The latest updates include administering the first asset management training class to 10 employees within our accounting organization. There are 3 additional training sessions scheduled for January in which we've targeted up to 240 more employees. The asset management curriculum includes content covering required documentation and workflow, FDA notification, property transfers, barcoding, biennial inventory, and employee accountability standards. The employee departments targeted for asset management training include finance, accounting, treasury, risk management, operations staff, investment recovery administrators, assigned property officers, and property coordinators. And while we've not received any formal FTA feedback since our last board update, we have been in close communication with our FTA regional staff and anticipate receiving the next round of feedback imminently. A recent significant progress step is that our 2 years' worth of remaining available FTA grant applications covering federal fiscal years 13 and 14 were completed and formally submitted to the FTA as of November 26th. And FDA began reviewing the applications immediately, and they're estimated to complete their review and submit to the DOL for the next step by the end of the week, by December 5th. Currently, our projection is that the grant awards will be finalized by either late December or early January. Yes, it is.
The unexpected DOL objection.
No. So I'd like to conclude by reviewing our next steps. My top priority is to ensure we achieve all of our progress milestone obligations and adhere to our review schedule commitments with FTA regional staff on our extended CAPS. We're continuing with all activities necessary to resolve all open grants issues and correctly draw against them. With having submitted grant applications for the remainder of our fiscal year 2014 and 15 grants, we'll address any revisions and follow-ups as our highest priorities. We're continuing to ramp up our internal compliance review activities for ensuring conformity with all applicable federal regulations, guidelines, and financial management controls. And we'll conduct the remaining scheduled training classes for updated asset management policies and procedures in January. So that concludes this month's FMO update report, Mr. Vice Chairman, and at this time I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Questions? Progress.
Progress.
Slow, but getting to the right place.
I'd just like to comment. I really think that one of the most significant things is our improved partnership with the FTA and FTA regional staff. Mm-hmm. It's really helped a lot.
So where is that with Region 4 in Philadelphia, or is that at headquarters, or both?
Region 3.
Three, I mean.
Philly. And Corey Walker is here from the region staff there in the back corner.
Who's Corey Walker?
Thank you, Corey.
Mr. Jeff. It's the local guy.
Thanks, Corey.
Just one quick question. If you could talk just briefly about our mechanism, internal mechanism controls, how we go about managing the controls environment to ensure that we are in alignment, that we're meeting all of our obligations, that, that protocols are being followed. What is the control mechanism that we have in place or that we're putting in place?
Well, it started certainly with, documenting our improved policies and adopting the policies, documenting all the procedures necessary for the new processes, make sure they're consistent with federal regulations, doing extensive training across all departments, finance, procurement, operations, all the departments, doing a lot of in-depth manual staff, close staff review of for proper documentation and adherence to the proper procedural guidelines, and then going forward, I think we're also going to be looking to see what kind of system improvements and changes we can make in our financial system to help monitor these and going forward.
One thing I might suggest we look at it. I know a number of outside private corporations and a lot of other government organizations have separate compliance units or groups within their business, and we may have that, but that actually their role is to ensure, as opposed to audit, ensure compliance.
I did forget to mention that. We are increasing the level of our internal compliance office. We're expanding it. It's also being elevated from within the accounting department to reporting to the CFO office, and there will be now a director and staff, and it will be their responsibility to ensure compliance with our new procedures and adherence to the right guidelines and regulations, particularly in the areas of grants management and procurement, contract administration.
Thank you very much.
On another subject, we've been talking for the last couple of months about having a good suite of financial indicators that would be reported regularly, similar to the vital signs that we use for operations. We've been zeroing in on those. There was a memo in Diligent last week, I think it was, with some suggestions on what those should be. I think it covers the ground pretty well. What we now need to be doing is working with staff to say, what will those measures look like? What are the targets we should be looking to achieve? What's the reporting cycle? But the right things are in there that would make it possible for us to feel we're getting the information we need to do our job of oversight.
Yeah, we've started actually having our staff reviews with to talk about how we're going to incorporate these oversight metrics in our monthly and quarterly financial reporting, reporting to the board. And I hope that we'll be coming back with at least a first cut, first view of things in January.
Mr. Downey,
yes.
On this particular topic, I would really appreciate it if staff would take it to JCC before it comes back here, since for many of us, our JCC members are doing a significant portion of the monitoring. I think that would be a really that would be a useful set of feedback to have.
Yeah, I think for each of these potential indicators, we need to say, why is it important? What is it really measuring? Frankly, is going up the number or down the number the right thing we're looking for? And sort of what is
right.
The target that we can say we're shooting for?
Yeah, I think
the right
things
are there.
I think your comparison to the KPIs is a good one, and
right.
It's trend analysis, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I would really appreciate having the staff take a look at it, too.
Budget?
Charles.
Good afternoon. Today we're presenting the general manager's proposed budget, both operating and capital, for fiscal year 16. This budget is meant and is designed to support the board's strategic plan, Momentum. Some of the principal objectives obviously are to, again, to sustain our safety efforts, sustain our state of good repair efforts, to sustain our financial stability efforts, and also to prepare us for Metro 2025 and addressing the core capacity issues in Metro Rail. I said it's to sustain progress, but it's also to enhance that progress. And All this will be discussed in more detail by Dennis and his staff in a few minutes. For instance, on the enhancing financial stability, the board made a correct policy decision to begin funding our other post-employment benefits, OPEB, a couple years ago, and this adds $11 million to the budget to do that. We are also, in terms of safety, going beyond what we've done thus far, especially with regard to fatigue risk management. This budget provides for enhanced resources to advance that. And the list goes on. We've also taken a look, hearing feedback from the board, and we do this annually, is to look at what efficiencies we can introduce into the budget to reduce costs, and you'll see some of that discussion having to do with abolishing funded vacancies that were mostly in the administrative area, as well as making other insourcing, outsourcing decisions, and a couple other efficiency things. We also looked at, in order to try to further reduce the amount of subsidy impact on the jurisdictions, we looked at a couple of business models that we've been talking about, discussing. One had to do with Metro Access. As you know, one of the increases in the budget is about another $7 million for Metro Access operating on top of the over $100 million that is subsidized every year. And this, we predicted, it's actuarial growth, but we also have been experimenting with a couple of the jurisdictions on ways to reduce the subsidy, reduce taxpayer costs, and actually increase, improve service for the customers that use Metro Access. This has to do, in Maryland, we've experimented with paratransit service being provided by a community service provider rather than Metro Access, and that was successful in the district. Through the work with the D.C. Taxi Commission, a subset of our customers are having made available to them accessible taxi cab service, which again provides more flexibility, is a better customer service, and saves money for everyone, taxpayer as well as Metro. So looking forward, we feel that we should more aggressively work those models to the point where, say, in Maryland, there's a number of other areas that potentially could provide paratransit service to community service organizations or human service organizations more cheaply and better than we do. So part of the budget proposal is to make some of that happen in the next year, and certainly over the long term, grow that model so that, again, people provide better service. Another part of the proposal was something we've been working on, has to do with the business model for buses. We are the regional provider of bus service, but we also provide local bus service in a number of the jurisdictions to varying degrees. That's subsidized 100% the local bus service by the jurisdictions. It shows up as part of the overall subsidy of Washington Metro. There's a study underway which will be completed middle of next year, which looks to transfer local bus service provided by Metro to the local bus services. Nearly all the jurisdictions have bus company and bus authorities that provide service today. It's now more clearly delineating and transferring to those authorities responsibility for local bus service. The extent that there's a cost savings to that has yet to be determined. It could be through efficiency, as also could be through just better cost effectiveness as the local decision makers making the decision about the bus service. But what's included in this budget is a first small step in that direction. Even if we, as we examine the long-term model, it'll take years to implement such a thing. But it is, again, taking a look at where best to put that bus service, whereas with WMATA, maintain the responsibility for regional bus service. And in fact, eventually growing that as priority corridor networks come on, into being, but again, shifting the cost model to move local bus service over to the local authorities who can already provide that local bus service. So that's part of the budget, a minor part. And that is, and we'll get to the numbers in a little bit, but that's where we stop. Important part of this proposal is no fare increase. Which is what the board has set up as a policy every other year to consider fare increases. We have also included, but it's not part of the proposal, an example of an option that would be available if there was a desire for a further cut in the subsidy provided by the jurisdiction, or reduction in the subsidy increase. And that involves the Metro Rail service, where you would expand the headways in the current service, both peak and off-peak, which would raise the number of average number of passengers in a car, not to exceed the maximum board policy, but certainly above the optimum board policy for that. And it gives you an example of what the dollar reduction in the subsidy would be. Again, it's not recommended here, but it's to give you an idea of the types of actions that could be taken to reduce the subsidy increase to the jurisdictions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dennis and his staff to go through it in detail, and obviously we'll have lots of discussion. Again, this is just part of the ongoing process.
Thank you, Rich. And good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Before walking you through the major items proposed in the budget, I want to draw your attention to the thermometer at the bottom of the slide. The $809 million figure on the left-hand corner of the slide is the current subsidy, while the $929 million figure on the lower right-hand side represents the subsidy that we discussed last month. This graphic would appear throughout the operating budget presentation to illustrate the subsidy impact of some of the options that are embedded in the GM's proposal. Last month, we previewed the FY16 operating revenue forecast, which showed a slight reduction from the FY15 budget, based, as you will recall, on the recent experience with respect to rail ridership. So the GM proposal that we're discussing today maintains that same baseline ridership figure, along with a presumed 2% increase in bus ridership, which collectively will result in FY16 revenue figure of $881 million. Again, this does not include the impact of some of the items that the GM just spoke about, and we will get to that in a few minutes. So starting with that $881 million figure, we go to non-fare revenue sources, which include things like advertising, leases, and fiber optic revenues, which collectively would add $52 million in terms of operating revenue, leading to a total of $933 million, a decline of 1.4% when you compare that to the FY15 budget. So when you look at the thermometer, that $13 million decline in terms of revenue is added to the subsidy need for FY16, which takes it to $822 million. I should note at this point that this forecast assumes that the current transit subsidy remains as is. Should Congress restore parity with respect to federal parking subsidy, we will indeed revisit the numbers and will make appropriate adjustments. Metro, as we all know, spends over 90 cents of every operating dollar delivering transit services to customers. And like other transit providers, Metro's operating costs are primarily driven by the men and women who operate Metro's buses and Metro's trains to deliver our customers to where they need to go. So personnel costs, including wages, healthcare, insurance, and personnel, account for over 70% of Metro's operating budget. But it's also the single biggest source of expense growth between FY15 and FY16. This growth, which is approximately $60 million, will fund the collective bargaining agreement commitment and increased healthcare costs, as well as pension costs that are in the budget. It also funds the board's commitment to reducing outstanding OPEB contribution, as the general manager mentioned a few minutes ago. Last year, Metro started this funding with $5 million, and this year, have included additional funds to make up for the catch-up that was not included in last year's budget in order to maintain the trajectory that this board approved. With respect to non-personnel costs, the GM's budget proposal reflects a smaller but still necessary increase to maintain service to customers. Overall, the total non-personnel cost, including services, materials, supplies, and energy, is projected to increase by $60 million, partially due to inflationary adjustments. But again, as the GM mentioned a little bit earlier, a major increase in this category is what we are seeing with respect to the additional need for Metro Access service costs, which will increase, in this case, by $7 million over the 15 baseline level. $7 million, yes. About 60% of Metro Access costs, again, customers reside in the state of Maryland. But ridership, we expect, will increase across the jurisdictions. And the rate of growth for Metro Access remains a major risk with respect to the budget for FY16. Now, Metro's top priority remains safety, and so that will drive everything that we do next year. As such, the FY16 budget will support efforts to close out the remaining NTSB recommendations and also prioritize wayside worker warning protection system in order to provide an additional level of protection for employees inspecting the right-of-way. Overall, total direct operating capital budget for safety activities in FY16 is approximately $330 million, which includes, of course, the $260 million for the 1,000 series rail cars replacement. With respect to customer care initiatives, the FY16 budget will include funding for Metro's award-winning public participation plan to ensure continued customer engagement. But Metro will also see in FY16 an improvement in tunnel compliance, which Blair mentioned a little bit ago. The new internal compliance office will be augmented to enable it to effectively serve the organization with respect to adherence to compliance, both internal and external. Finally, the baseline budget is lower than it would otherwise be, thanks to the various actions that this organization had taken in the past to reduce operating costs. Most notably, I should point out that pension costs are lower than it would be due to the employee cost-sharing efforts that this organization engaged with in the past. And other recent initiatives, including garage lighting, will begin to pay dividends in the near future. So in addition to ongoing safety activities, the FY16 budget will provide resources to support the board's mandate with respect to fatigue risk management. These resources, as you see on this slide, will fund additional employees to further improve and maintain compliance with Metro's hours of service policy. Specifically, 75 bus operators, 18 track repairers, and 4 dispatchers at a cost of about $5 million will be added in FY16 to help propel this initiative. With these resources, management will continue to monitor this program in FY16 to help determine if further actions are necessary. In addition to fatigue management, the GM's proposal includes other initiatives designed to reduce costs or enhance organizational efficiency. For example, collaborative risk management will elevate and drive enterprise risk management across the enterprise to help us manage the organization a lot better. In addition, human resource modernization will be an effort to support employee recruitment, development, and retention efforts, again, to make sure that we are hiring the right employees and retaining them appropriately. And finally, competitive parts procurement will help Metro to comply with FTA guidelines and reduce future costs as we better define the parts that we buy and make them available to the general public to help provide. Along with those, we were also insourcing elevator and escalator maintenance, shifting that work from the outside to the inside at a more competitive price. And as the GM also mentioned, we're also looking at opportunities to outsource some of the functions that we're doing now with respect to revenue collections and the security associated with those collections. In response to the sentiments expressed by the committee when we spoke on these issues last month, the GM directed that a number of initiatives be included in the budget. But in doing that, there was also a few things that were excluded. As you heard a little bit earlier, with respect to the bus priority corridor network, we have excluded in the proposed budget some of the things that the customers have asked for in the past. We've also not included cleanliness with respect to bus vehicles and bus stations. In addition, additional teams that were needed to help with rail buckling and cracking in terms of inspections has not been included. Or backup emergency response team to enhance the current level of emergency response capabilities. So without further changes beyond those described above, the total operating subsidy for FY16 would be $904 million. An increase of more than 11% over FY15. But to further reduce the required contribution, the GM has directed that we make additional changes. A key cost reduction for FY14 will reduce positions across Metro, and this touches not just administrative units, but all other units across the organization, focusing primarily on 200 vacant non-safety-sensitive positions across the organization. Based on conversations with all of those units, 25% of these positions, about 50 positions in all, will be eliminated in FY16, saving $5 million annually, including salary and fringe benefits. While eliminating these positions will have some business impacts, they are not expected to negatively impact safety or customer service. Furthermore, the affected departments have confirmed that eliminating these positions will not prevent the achievement of their FY16 business plan objectives. Now, I want to step away from the FY16 budget for a moment and talk about the need for a longer term changes to Metro's model for both Metro Bus and Metro Access, as the GM spoke about a little bit earlier. To be clear, such future shifts is not intended to reduce the level of service to transit riders or to reduce the level of transit funding. Rather, the focus here is that enhancing local control of service will also enable Metro to focus on the regional service, again, as the GM indicated a little bit earlier. So in the case of both Metro Access and Metro Bus Services, this shift is intended to leverage the other alternatives that are currently exist in the communities that we serve to maintain the level of service that we currently provide to customers. For Metro Access, more service coordination will certainly help the growth to moderate the growth in both trips and subsidy, especially given the potential of some of the pilot programs that we see at this time. In the District of Columbia, where taxis are being used to prevent or rather to transport dialysis patients, and in the state of Maryland, where community support service organizations are assisting in access services delivery. In this pilot, some Metro Access customers are being transported at a cheaper price and lower cost to the jurisdictions. The DC program is expected to carry up to 100,000 clients. a year when fully rolled out, which translates to reduced subsidy to Metro of approximately $5 million and a net savings to the district of about $2 million. These changes, as you can see, could potentially have significant impact on both Metro and the jurisdictions. As part of the FY16 budget proposal, Metro Access has already identified four additional human service agencies in Maryland who could become part of the pilot programs, as shown on this slide. If all four agencies indeed participate, the state of Maryland could reduce its contribution by $1 million and save approximately $400,000 in FY16. If not, the budgeted subsidy level embedded in the budget proposal that Jim is presenting today will need to be increased to cover the expected service requests. And again, as you heard a little bit earlier, although structural changes cannot be achieved overnight, the board and Metro as a whole should consider future changes as discussed earlier today by the GM. Again, for example, recalibrating the regional network and bus, focusing on regional services that Metro can provide and non-regional lines that the local jurisdictions can provide will clearly reduce the current cost structure. Strategic changes of this nature, which have been discussed in various venues in the past, will give the jurisdictions more control over the level of service on truly local routes and allow Metro to focus on improving regional mobility and connecting communities by providing efficient and more effective regional routes or regional services. Such changes will reduce the footprint for Metro bus, and depending on how you count, could go from 20 to up to 30% reduction in the current footprint. Obviously, to the extent that the board chooses to go in this direction, it will be implemented over a significant number of years, given the relative impact in terms of fleet size, garage facilities, and the labor force. But for FY15, the GM's proposed budget contemplates a phased transfer of a limited set of routes to local bus service providers that will result in a first-year cost savings of $8 million with no impact on current Metro employees. Again, this proposed transfer of service is not intended to reduce the level of bus service or total regional support for bus, although local contributions to Metro will be reduced and the jurisdictions will be able to operate these services at a lower cost. If the service levels are maintained, the total peak bus requirements, including spares for the routes that will be transferred in FY16, is about 100. But as noted earlier, the annual Metro bus operating reduction for this reallocation is about $8 million, with associated revenue impact of about $1.2 million, leading to a net subsidy reduction of $6.8 million. So with the base operating requirements, new initiatives, and efficiencies described above, the proposed FY16 budget is $1.8 billion. A 3.9% increase over FY15. The estimated gross subsidy for FY16 is $892 million, an increase of $84 million, or 10% over FY15. These amounts are approximately $36 million less the subsidy figure presented in November, and reflect an effort to balance the regional transit needs with the resource constraints that the region faces. And while the GM's budget does not recommend it, there are other options, as he mentioned a little bit earlier, with respect to Metro Rail headway that this board could consider. Such difficult choices to realign service in line with constrained funding could reduce operating costs by about $24 million, with a corresponding reduction in revenues of about $11 million. Finally, the FY16 budget does not recommend fare changes. However, Metro could begin an in-depth review of Metro Rail fares as part of FY17 budget process. Such a review could focus on the cost of rail fare relative to driving, particularly in the current fuel price environment, the relationship between distance and fare price, and the level of bus fare relative to rail. Given the inelasticity of transit demand and across-the-board fare reduction would suddenly boost ridership, but it will also increase the need for higher subsidy contribution. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will turn the presentation over to Tom Webster, Managing Director for OMBS, to discuss the capital program. And as you know, Tom has been involved with Metro 2025 and in the ongoing CFA renegotiations.
Thank you, Dennis. So the proposed FY16 capital budget totals $1.3 billion, and the proposed six-year capital improvement program plan totals an investment of $7 billion over that six-year period. The capital program continues Metro's investments in safety and state of good repair investments and advances Metro 2025 priority projects for eight-car trains and bus priority corridor network enhancements. Of the $7 billion, approximately $5.5 billion is for safety and state of good repair investments, and $1.5 billion is for the Metro 2025 projects. The proposed, of the $1.3 billion proposed FY16 program, approximately $850 million of the investment is for ongoing annual state of good repair and safety projects, and the remaining $450 million is for non-recurring investments. Dennis mentioned earlier where the FY16 budget includes approximately $260 million for railcar purchases. There are also $130 million replacement buses included in the program. So while the $1.3 billion FY16 capital budget is historically the largest budget we will have had, there are components of that budget that are equipment and vehicle deliveries that that make up a large portion of the increased amount. The FY16 to 2021 proposed CIP financial plan assumes that federal formula funding will continue at current levels, approximately $293 million per year through the six-year period. Federal formula funding includes the urbanized area program funding, state of good repair program funding, and the bus and bus facilities program. Financial plan also assumes the continued annual appropriation of $150 million of federal PREA funding, Passenger Rail Investment Improvement Act funding, as well as the associated match from the State of Maryland, the District of Columbia, and the Commonwealth of Virginia. PREA funding is focused on Metro Rail safety and state of good repair projects, so it's really a critical that funding source continues. The plan also assumes, as Dennis mentioned, that the capital funding agreement among Metro and the regional funding partners will be renewed before the beginning of FY16 in order to support the program for the next 6 years and to incorporate the funding for eight-car trains and the bus priority network improvements. Capital funding agreement provides the structure and the mechanism through which the jurisdictions provide the required local local funding to match federal formula grants, as well as jurisdictional system performance funds. As a reminder, the option to purchase the 220 rail cars to support the eight-car train program expires in August of 2015, which is the beginning of the FY16 budget year. Negotiations of the renew the capital funding agreement are progressing. The financial plan also assumes the issuance and usage of $590 million of long-term financing, long-term debt, that will support projects between FY16 and FY2021. The plan also assumes the additional regional investment in the Metro 2025 projects, primarily the eight-car train program and the bus priority program, an additional investment of $1.3 billion over the six-year period, $77 million of which would be in the FY16 time period. So approximately the same amount as was invested in through the FY15 budget. That $77 million is what would be required to continue both of those programs, the eight-car train program and the bus priority program, on the current schedule. As I mentioned, the program, the primary focus of the program over the next 6 years will continue to be safety and state of good repair, as well as next year in FY16. The 16 budget will continue to advance the critical safety and rebuilding projects that have been the focus of the program for the last several years. Some examples: in FY16, Metro expects to take delivery of 190 rail cars for the replacement of 1,000 series rail cars. We expect to continue to work on the capital projects that are associated with the NTSB recommendations. We expect to replace approximately 130 Metro buses and rehabilitate 100 more Metro buses. Expect to replace 23 and rehabilitate 25 escalators, so 48 in total, replacements and rehabilitations, and to rehabilitate 16 elevators across the system. The plan continues the substantial investment in track and structures, repair, replacement, and rehabilitation to achieve a steady state of maintenance. And two of our major construction projects will be underway at Cinderbed Road and Andrews Federal Campus bus facilities. As part of the authority-wide transit asset management policy and strategies introduced by the GM in 2013, WMATA has now developed asset management plans for major asset areas in line with the MAP 21 federal requirements. Those plans are in draft form. When these plans are finalized and receive final approval, more detailed data collection and implementation efforts will begin, and future capital planning and programming processes will be guided by those asset management plans. With the $1.5 billion planned investment in the eight-car train program between now and 2021, 220 expansion vehicles will be delivered and in service by the fall of 2021. The yard capacity projects at New Carrollton and the heavy repair and overhaul facilities will be complete to store and maintain those cars. Power upgrades across the system will be over 90% complete by 2021, or fiscal 2021, and Metro Rail will be able to operate current service with eight-car trains by the end of 2021. Beyond 2021 investments, major investments would be 72 additional expansion rail cars and improvements to the Brentwood and Glenmont yards. For the Bus Priority Corridor Network Program, the $110 million planned investment between now and 2021 would result in 120 expansion buses purchased to support the priority corridor network deployment. Metro will complete the transit signal prioritization project on Leesburg Pike, which is program funded by the Tiger Grant Program. Metro will continue the phased deployment of PCN lines using those buses throughout the compact area. But, of course, that plan to purchase expansion buses over the next 6 years assumes that the jurisdictions around the region will make the required associated roadway and traffic signal infrastructure investments. Future beyond 2021 investments would include additional expansion buses and a future bus facility for maintenance and storage, and then, of course, the full deployment of the priority corridor network. This final capital slide shows the distribution of the Metro 2025 program between FY16 and 2021. I mentioned the 1.5, 1.6 billion investment in total for Metro 2025. Approximately 250 million of that investment is already built into our existing financial plan and capital program. 1.3 billion would be additional investment required to advance those projects on schedule above and beyond what is currently committed to Metro and embedded in the financial plan. That concludes the capital portion of the presentation. And briefly on next steps, we will continue, obviously, budget discussions in January and the spring, expect to have a successful finalization of the new capital funding agreement and adoption of the FY16 operating budget and capital multi-year capital improvement program later in the spring. Thank you.
Yeah, page 4, thank you for your report. It's very thorough and took a lot of work, I know, so I appreciate that. Page 47 talks about the strategic initiatives out of 70 and 47. Let me get back to it here. Can you talk a little bit about what is meant by the human resources organizational modernization to support employee engagement, what that is, what's it entail?
With respect to this particular activity, the HR organization, it has been a while since Metro took a top-to-bottom review of what we're doing, what is the goal, and how we're approaching those goals in order to make sure that as an organization, we know fundamentally what type of an employer that Metro wants to be or needs to be to effectively serve our customers. And so part of the effort here will be the use of external experts to help us make that determination and then define the appropriate processes around it that will allow us to be an effective HR organization and ultimately an effective organization as a whole.
Okay. All right. Second question, same chart, insourcing of escalator maintenance. We've had previous discussions on this. As I recall, one of the reports you were going to give us was some sort of cost-benefit analysis of in-house versus out-house. thought I'd loosen up the group a little bit here. But I haven't seen that report yet. We did have a kind of an internal audit on some of the in-house versus out-house escalator maintenance, and I guess we saw that there were apples and oranges. We couldn't really compare them. So, I mean, are we going to see some sort of more detailed cost-benefit about whether it's better to keep it in-house or out-of-house or a combination of both?
Part of the reason that we did the that we looked at insourcing that is we did exactly that. We did the analysis on that, provided that to the OMBAS office for review. They looked at that. We really tried to identify it. You know, I made staff say apples to apples what it is. We took out all the variances that were in there in regards to, you know, newer escalators that they were maintaining, exactly what it would be. We found that we do have cost savings in that arena, that we can actually, you know, with our in-house forces can do it better. I don't see any reason why that information could not be provided to the board.
I mean, you don't see any benefit of having a combination of both?
At this point, no.
Could I, I'm sorry, follow up on this. The Inspector General's initial report showed that you all had no defensible comparative data between in-house and outhouse. You had different measures. I think if we're going to consider this, you have to report to the board on the criteria you used, the data that resulted in the finding that you could actually save money by bringing this in-house. I've been on the board long enough that I have seen three iterations of this: in-house, outhouse, in-house, mixed. The data has never, as far as I'm concerned, been adequate for the board to make an informed decision about bringing the entire escalator maintenance operation in-house. And I think you owe it to the board to be able to present that data as part of this budget proposal.
Certainly. Tony.
Good afternoon, and thanks for the presentation. I have a question about the non-personnel costs, power and utilities. What are your assumptions, because it's listed as an increase for 16? What are the assumptions for 14, 15, and 16 when it comes to power and utilities?
The baseline assumptions reflect some minimal adjustments with respect to consumption. And the history has been, particularly with respect to fuel, that, you know, there's a fuel hedge that will be implemented early in January, particularly given where pricing is. But even with that, when you look on the longer end of the curve, the prices are not as low as they are today. That said, the increases that you have in those two categories reflect where we believe that the market will be, one, and the limited enhancements in terms of consumption. But collectively, the overall growth is minimal compared to previous years. And the risk that we have as an organization is to reduce that significantly and then have to respond to the market, because except for fuel, we are subject to market volatility with respect to electricity. And suddenly, I've been advised that with respect to the CNG component, there's a differential here tied to a tax credit that is no longer available to us. So that those three things combined is why you're seeing an increase in those categories.
Thank you.
But I would also say, can I just follow up?
Sure.
The tax credit, if I remember rightly, is about $3 to $4 million. The increase is larger than that. That assumes that going forward, we're going to pay power and propulsion costs that are equal to this year going forward. I think that every reasonable energy forecast agency from the World Bank on has forecasted that the current depressed prices will last at least a year and perhaps 2 years, and making an assumption that our prices are going to be, our energy price is going to be pegged at the estimates for energy, both diesel and electric, that were cooked into this year's budget over a year ago. Doesn't seem to makes sense, and it would be an area where it would help us all if there was a further explanation about the assumptions that you're making in this process about energy prices
both diesel and electric.
Yeah, so if you could provide that for us.
We do.
Also, let me ask, well, to the tax credit, is that one of the things that will be in a one-year extender bill? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that will,
that's my understanding.
Yeah, that, so that may come back.
CNG?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Harry?
I'd ask staff.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I know. I think it's one of those.
I seem to recall that WMATA did a very successful parking garage lighting performance contracting agreement. I think it was with Phillips. And I don't know what the dollar amount of the savings was to WMATA. I do know that there was no cost associated with it, but I'd be interested to know the savings. And I'm just wondering why we wouldn't be trying to do that with station lighting, with tunnel lighting, maybe look to do something that would limit our heating and cooling and automate that in the trains so that when we reached a certain temperature that we wouldn't be providing that. And what about our escalators? A heck of a lot of power, I know, goes for our escalators. I've been on systems where the escalators didn't move when there was no passenger waiting to use them. Are those things that have been explored or that we could explore? I think we have still a lot of opportunity potentially to reduce our operating costs, and I think it also helps to buy some goodwill with our jurisdictions to really leave no stone unturned in terms of looking for those cost savings. Thank you.
Thanks. I missed Mr. Gold, but I'll pick him up and then keep going around the table.
We're sort of going counterclockwise and then clockwise, whatever it may be. Dennis and Tom, thank you for your updates. This is certainly moving in the right direction, better than the sort of preview of the FY16 budget you provided a couple months ago. I wanted to ask you some general questions and tell you where I'm going from about 30,000 feet and then drill down on some specific issues. And the slide I just want to focus on is the one that captioned FY2016 proposed operating budget, which there shows, of course, that where your preview was at $919 million in terms of a subsidy need, you've come down to a proposed subsidy need of $883 million. But, of course, that still leaves the jurisdictions paying $103 million more than they paid for this year, FY, or will have to pay for this year, FY2015. But I got to tell you that I think the $103 million is something you need to be adjustment because it's based on building in your idea of recalibrating these bus services and an assumption that services now operated by Metrobus will flow out and be operated by the jurisdiction. So realistically, in my mind, I have to adjust that and say that the real hit right now for the jurisdictions is probably in the range of $110 or $111 million. And so from my perspective, coming from Maryland, where I think you have to end up from your $111 million is to keep cutting by about another $35 million and bring that down to a range of about $70 million or $75 million in terms of the increase for all the jurisdictions. If it's going to be a credible proposal that's going to get past the finish line in terms of, at least in terms of Maryland, my colleagues from Virginia to district may be more or less aggressive, but that's sort of where I would be telling you to shoot for if you want to have an FY16 budget that really makes some sense. And I appreciate that while it's not in the budget, you have come forward with the proposal on the increasing the rail headways, and that's certainly a proposal that we should look at. But even that is only about one-third of that goal. That's going to save maybe $10-12 million. It's not really going to get you to this total of $30 or $35 million that I think you should be shooting for. So having looked at that big picture, I just want to explore some of these ideas with you. First, in terms of the recalibration, which I think involves got about 107 routes in from Montgomery County with ride on, I think you've identified about 19 routes. Would I be correct in trying to describe this proposal as basically what you're saying is that for WMATA, the cost of operating these 107 routes now is, you know, produces costs that are 8 million greater than the revenues that you're receiving from the passengers using those services. Is that a fair way to describe what's going on here?
That's correct.
I think the number was 6 million after revenue.
Yeah, but in terms of the actual cost, the actual cost element, it means that our costs are $8 million more than the revenues that we're getting from operating these bus routes. So under your proposal, who picks up that $8
million? The idea is that the level of service provided to clients, to our customers, remains the same. The local jurisdictions, based on where the services are, will be picking up the service and correspondingly, you know, saving on the contributions to Metro.
All right, so in the case of Ride On would anticipate if a route is transferred over, it would still be getting the same amount of revenue from people using the service,
right,
and its cost would be the same. So either Montgomery County or the state of Maryland would have to pick up that, whatever that share of that $8 million difference is for these routes that are being transferred.
If the cost turns out to be the same, there's a presumption here that the cost would be slightly different. And to that extent, the state of Maryland or Montgomery County in this particular case will benefit from that exercise.
Right. And so what is your assumption as to why the costs are different or lower for Montgomery County on Ride-On, let's say, as opposed to Metrobus?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, without fully evaluating their cost structure, I can't tell you precisely. But that you have, as an organization, an infrastructure that embeds a degree of fixed cost. You have to, I mean, whether you're providing one service or not, I mean, that impacts ultimately what your overall total cost is. And to the extent that we can address that, or we can find a cheaper cost delivery alternatives, what we're suggesting here is that the jurisdictions ought to benefit from that, and therefore we think that this is a rational way to address some of the cost constraints that this board is dealing with.
Let me add to that. There's two things. One is each jurisdiction has an opportunity to review what it costs to provide local bus services versus what it pays to WMATA to provide those services. They can determine whether or not there would be a cost savings to them. That's the first thing. The second thing is, and this is not something you can do with accounting, is my view is that when the funding, the people who decide on the amount of money to spend on something is closer to the decision making in terms of the service to be provided, they might make more cost-effective decisions. Right now, it sort of folds into the overall subsidy to Metro, this local bus service. So it sort of gets further separation. So it has the potential of being less cost-effective decisions. So this really devolves to the local jurisdiction to say, this is the service we want, and this is what we're willing to pay for it, and we control the cost directly.
No, I think it does have the potential to be that way. As I said, I don't think it's going to happen in FY16, you know, which is why.
Right, that's why we present it as clearly as this is what would be the reduction in subsidy to WMATA, recognizing that the jurisdiction of the state, depending on where you're located, would be picking up the cost. The amount that would actually be saved net for the taxpayer is something the jurisdiction can best calculate.
Mr. Chairman, could I follow up on this?
Can I just ask two more questions? On this particular issue, I just want to make sure I understand this. Have you provided a list, or do you have a list of these routes, and have you provided it yet to the jurisdictions? Does Ride-On in Montgomery County have a list of the 19 routes that you're talking about so they can begin an evaluation of those routes and take a look at them and see if this proposal makes sense from Ride-On's point of view.
Sure. We had talked about this proposal with the JCC at a high level at the most recent meeting, and we intend to provide the detailed, you know, we were sort of, these routes were chosen as sort of candidate routes, the most likely candidates that could be moved over in a relatively quick fashion, you know, located close to existing garages for the local providers and so forth. We absolutely intend to look at that list in detail with the staff and talk about it with them.
And what's the timetable for that?
We have a JCC meeting
within
in
a week
or two.
A month or something like that?
At the JCC meeting later this month.
Okay. And just one more question, and I'll cede the floor temporarily to the chair.
Yeah.
Does your proposal contemplate that?
We'll have another round if you have more questions.
Yes.
I do want to. Yeah.
All right. Let me just ask this one, then I'll.
Yeah.
I do have more questions. Does your proposal contemplate just transferring the buses to the local jurisdiction so they can use them so that their only cost is going to be drivers and whatever subsidy they want to pay?
That will certainly be part of the conversation as we go forward, along obviously with making sure that the FTA is in agreement with whatever we decide to do collectively.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm following that. So that's part of the discussion? And so they would just repaint the buses and put their own drivers on, and if they wanted
if
to
the
do it.
If the Public Transit Administration agrees that the capital investment in those buses can be transferred to the jurisdictions, oftentimes they do not approve that.
Okay, I have another couple of questions, but I'll
we'll come around
take the second round.
Ms. Porter, do you have a question?
No.
Ms. Hines?
Thank you. I just went to the website to try to find the full document. And I don't see it yet. It's not coming up when I search. So my question is, when will the full document be available? And my second is a request that board members please be provided a hard copy of the document. We didn't have it last year. It was harder to work through. So please, could we have that? Bus routes was one of the things on my list, and Mr. Goldman's asked a number of questions. I would just say, for the benefit of my colleagues, that Arlington has worked really successfully with WMATA over the last so many years to bring routes that were less productive into our stable and then make local decisions. And it's been a real win, I think, for all of us. This is a way to control your subsidy payment, because it's your dollars that are paying 100% for these local routes. And so I just think we all have to recognize that there are some tools we have at our disposal should we choose to take them. You know, that's a different story, but I really want to say that, and we've done it quite successfully. We are looking forward to the list. That would be very helpful to us to have as soon as possible. I would encourage you all to put it out before the JCC meeting so that they can come in with their questions, and that robust conversation can begin. Mr. Chairman, my last question is really for you. It certainly is a little bit like a murder board for these guys to have to sit here and respond to questions all over the map today. It really would be my hope that we can schedule some work sessions moving forward where we have clarity around the topics that are going to be discussed so that we can come in with organized questions and organized conversation, and our staff can be there with us so that we really work through this and develop a deeper understanding, because that's what's going to have to happen to make this work. There are certainly many questions about growth in employees over the years, reorganizations that have been done, functions we've had to beef up, how that all fits together. And, it's certainly been noted that personnel costs are an enormous, enormous part of this budget. And I think we are at a point where we collectively have to understand that better. Given what we've been through in the last 4 years and what we're facing moving forward. And so I really be happy to help structure that and think through the topics, but I think on the operating budget we really owe it to ourselves to spend quality time having thoughtful, deep conversations.
Yeah, I think it would be very helpful to do that, and if people could get really even sooner rather than later the areas that you think this would be, sooner rather than later, to the areas that we want to dig into. It's going to take a lot of digging to get to where we all need to be comfortable.
Thank you. I won't go back to the bus transfer other than to say that I think over a longer period of time this has potential for at least the value of savings trade-offs, but I think that's really one of the concerns. I just wanted to go back to the human services aspect. I think I saw that we were looking at $7 million growth in Metro Access services, and that where we have shifted, we seemingly were making progress. And one of the areas that we talked about at budget time last year was the coordination around the human services community. And it's almost back to the same where we are with the bus issue, because as deliverers of the services, we have the best opportunity, one, to serve those customers best, but the dialysis program seems like a really good start, but I think we really do need to find and get back to that discussion we had at last budget about what are the commonalities that we can have and bring back to our own jurisdictional role that we can play. And that's the part. And I think it can happen without losing the role that WMATA plays in a larger wide system, regional-wide system, but a much more cost-effective system. And while dialysis has been pulled out here, it could be many other things.
I might suggest that might be one of the workshop topics. And, again, Arlington is probably one of the best examples of having taken on paratransit.
Right.
And there's have a very small contribution to the Metro Access budget because of providing better service.
Mm-hmm. But does provide a service that
right.
meets the needs.
Right.
So if we can see that the service is provided better and cheaper,
that's
it really
it
warrants our doing the effort to get there.
In terms of Ms. Hines' suggestion, I'd point out that one of the footnotes in the timing expectations about the budget is that it's scheduled for the board approving a public hearing docket in January, which includes determinations of, for instance, are there Title VI impacts about the proposed changes in budget or changes in access? An assumption that between now and, say, the third week in January that we can get to an agreement about what we would post for the public hearing agenda for the docket for this is mighty tight. Perhaps we should look at the impact of a public hearing docket in February, because I don't want to take a half-baked set of issues to the public and create a lot of confusion about what we're asking them to comment on. It's just, it's a serious timing issue. This is a very complex set of issues, particularly about bus service.
So I'd ask if you could take a look at the timeline. When do we want these things implemented and back up to that, giving time for us to really think it through and still do what we have to do, particularly if you can focus on the Title VI work that would need to be done,
yep.
and also whether there is any 13C implications of some of these transfers before we get too far down the road with them. Mr. Bolger.
Can I finish?
Oh, I thought you were done.
Nope. bus routes. And the proposal, there are two big questions hanging over this that need an answer. One is, if the buses pass, or if there are shared use options about existing bus garages, a 20% to 30% overall reduction in bus service means a 20% to 30% transfer of operating capacity, i.e.
bus bays.
The district has been looking very hard for a new bus garage to satisfy circulator issues. It's very difficult in a dense inner urban environment to find
Busket Rogers, as the authority knows. A more important question is the designated bus grant recipient for this region is the authority. That means that bus funding, bus garages, et cetera, all that funding comes to this authority. If the routes are passed, is there an agreement that is possible about the jurisdictions being able to receive formula bus funding, or is it the assumption in your budget that those funds would continue to flow 100% to the authority? I don't know what the answer is, and it's probably not, but it's a serious issue. While it may be possible to make the operating side a little cheaper, it is not possible to make that happen without significant capital over the short and longer term. And those capital costs are a serious cost to the jurisdictions and need to be clarified. A suggestion on that we consider is the catch-up on OPEB. This is not, frankly, a good year to catch up for the decision that we made on this year's budget. Continuing it at the level that we put it in for this year is more realistic, because if we have a fare increase in 17, the issue could be better addressed in the light of additional revenue. And that's $2 to $3 million bucks to do the catch up. I know it's 11, but
last year we did 4.
Right.
Yeah. But a bump of 7.
It's a bump of 7 to be able to catch up from what we didn't do this last year. And I'm not suggesting foregoing any increase in OPEB, but a more realistic number would help us. The pension payment, I didn't understand fully the calculation of the authority's pension payment. While we're crediting into the account 3% of employee wages as part of our labor contract being fully actuated, it looks like our pension contribution, the authority's pension contribution, is going up in addition to the increased funds flowing into the pension funds from the employees. And I don't understand it, and perhaps we could get a focus on what that means, yeah, and how we're structuring that estimate of the authority's pension payment. The last thing I had is we're adding 50-some-odd positions to treat safety and overtime issues. And our overtime doesn't reflect in any way, the estimate of overtime doesn't reflect the addition of 52 positions, I think it is. And there has to be payback, there has to be some payoff for making the investment in additional personnel. But the overtime estimate that I saw in the budget doesn't reflect that investment. And it would be great for the board to know what the payback is and when it starts to see where we can see a reduction in the overtime budget. And frankly, we haven't had any decreases in overtime budget that met our budget expectations for the last several years. And it would be a shame to have an increase, however slight, in overtime after we put 50-some-odd positions into the authority's budget to reduce it.
Yeah, another thing to be looked at. Tom.
Well, as usual, the chairman asked the question about designated recipient for federal funding, and that's, I think, needs to be reinforced. work out with the, our staffs. Just to reiterate the district's situation about, you know, buying rolling stock and bus facilities and sharing in the designated recipient federal FDA funds. I don't know how you want to handle that, but that certainly should be on the table. I just have one question beyond that was, under our current labor agreement, we asked our employees to make contributions to the retirement program. Is that happening at 100%? Do we know?
It's scaled up. It starts 3%.
No. Let me rephrase the question. Are our employees making the contributions that are in the labor agreement?
Yeah, they're not voluntary.
Wondering whether are they making the contributions, period? Are they making the contributions?
But they don't have a choice. It comes out of their pay.
Okay, I just want to make sure that...
Getting done. Alvin, you have questions on operating?
Thank you for the presentation. I appreciate it. I do have a couple of questions. A lot of the points I wanted to make were raised earlier, but I do want to add a point of emphasis to a couple. With respect to the Metro Access, again, and piggybacking on the comments of Kathy, I want to be able to have that discussion in the context of what we had requested last year, and that is the look at the, in a larger region, on the cost and the human quality, the human impact of Metro Access as a service throughout the entire region, and recognizing that the real cost of this is associated with quality of life for all of our residents, the community. I think the highlighted of the examples there, I think clearly are the kinds of projects that exploration that makes a difference, but do want to see that in the context of the larger discussion that we talked about last year. And perhaps that's your intention to do that, but I want to make sure that we talk about that. I know Christian's talked about it a little bit as he's come forward reporting periodically. Second thing is on the bus route changes, suggestions about the local service. I think that is a good discussion. I agree. I think that it, again, important to evidence the cost efficiency of that. If it changes and it's a more efficient cost, I think that that's a number one priority. I think that also for me, though, it raises the larger question of discussing what are the most appropriate kinds of service for us to deliver at the regional level versus the local level, and to be able to discuss that in the context of our overall strategy for the overall system.
That overall plan and is scheduled for presentation in June or July of next year.
And to the point
that... we can update you on where we are in the discussion.
I think it's critically important, and to the point that Michael made earlier, simply transferring it doesn't necessarily assume that it's a cost savings, and it to the jurisdictions, if the... the cost, it's still going to be a cost, so it may create a greater efficiency in terms of cost here, but if it doesn't realize a cost at the jurisdictional level, then from a subsidy standpoint or an investment standpoint, however you want to make it, it's still going to be a cost that has to be recognized and dealt with, and we need to understand that and really understand that it's an efficient change. The other piece that is interesting to me, too, though, is that we've highlighted that 70% of our operating budget is personnel costs, which is important. It's the biggest part of the cost. It's also our most important asset that we have, the quality of our people, and really am happy to see the strategic initiative around human resources, like very much to understand in a robust sense exactly what we're going to do and why, and the plan and the objective and what we want to be able to accomplish in a substantive discussion. I think it's important. I'm glad that it's there, but I'd like to understand clearly what we want to accomplish and how it relates there. Last piece related to that, when we talk about 25% reducing our 25% of non-essential staff, and you know, I'd like for us to get to the point. I don't mean to be crass in this regard.
25% vacancy.
In non-essential staff? Non-safety.
Right.
Did the term say non-essential? Though I think we talked about non-essential on the...
Sensitive.
Non-sensitive.
Non-safety sensitive.
Non-safety sensitive.
Right.
Okay, so 25% of non-safety sensitive positions.
200
vacancies.
Vacancies, right, right. So it's 50 positions.
Eliminated.
You see, I'm a little challenged on that one right now.
Well, there's a lot of numbers floating around.
Well, it's what's important about it for me is that the to fully understand what that means,
mm-hmm.
and I don't really know what non-sensitive means either, or non-safety sensitive means either. And technically speaking, any position we have ought to be essential and necessary, essential and necessary, not unnecessary.
That's why we didn't call it essential. We're not essential.
Well, and to the extent that we have non-essential positions, I'm happy to see those eliminated, particularly when there are vacancies. I don't, you know, that's the best opportunity that we have. But I'm seeking some clarity, some significant clarity on it.
My understanding, too, on that point, that each of the respective managers had looked at their level of vacancies and agreed that they could absorb that loss and still produce what they're supposed to produce.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Well, I guess eliminating a vacancy doesn't necessarily save us any money, though.
We would budget to pay them.
And so are we realizing the savings in our budget surplus for this year, or budget deficit for this year, that – I mean, there's corollary there. All right, I'll pursue it later. Thank you.
Matt, did you have questions?
No, I mean, I was just thinking about the comments that were made, especially Ms. Hines, Mr. Goldman. I mean, this is obviously a tight budget year for Metro and for the jurisdictions, and I hope in our discussions going forward that we can look at the kinds of things that have been talked about, but also as surgical reductions as we can. I mean, I appreciate you putting forward the initiative to reduce headways. If there's a way to do that in a more surgical way, so that there's less impact on customers. I mean, I really think we've got to balance the jurisdictions and their financial situation, our financial situation, the district, and also taking care of our customers. And I just look forward to doing that in a thoughtful way.
I mean, we'll come back on capital, but I think we have established that there's a willingness to look at this bus route change. And what would help is to the extent you can lay out the pro forma operating and capital costs that are associated with it and get some concurrence with the jurisdictions, and then we'll make decisions.
Right.
But I think Mary's point that Arlington has done this for years and profited from it, and Alexandria as well, it's absolutely something we should do. The other question I would have is, if we carry ourselves far enough in that direction, are there overhead savings within the authority that might also flow?
Right. And I just want to add that, and I appreciate the comments on surgical. Surgical gets you so much, but what is really important in these workshops and dialogue is feedback from the jurisdictions of areas that they're willing to see a little less, accomplished in the coming year because we have to cut back. So it's not just a matter of cost cutting; it's the impacts of those cost cutting. We need that feedback.
Mort, if I could just add one other thing, I was remembering yesterday that the RAC last year really provided us with great advice, as did AAC. They came in, they had been thoughtful, they had debated things. And I'm just wondering in this year whether it's worth it to think about taking that even a step further in some way early to say to our riders, we're open to thoughts you might have. Recognizing that nobody really likes to talk about service changes, but sometimes folks see things because they live it every day where they think, if Metro made this shift, maybe it would make a difference. So I'm not, and I think we also have to put it in this context of 13.3% is still a big budget increase. When I look at what my budget is likely to increase in Arlington, it's nowhere near that number. And so we have to say, you know, we're trying not to raise fares. Your localities are trying to keep a lid on their costs. So there's not a whole lot of other places for us to go. So give us your best thinking. And maybe things will arise that we would not have thought of. And I think when you invite the public into the conversation appropriately, that when you get to the end, more people understand why you ended up where you end up. So I would just encourage us to think about how, I mean, we've used Mind Mixer, we've used other tools before, but I would really encourage it to start sooner rather than later.
I mean, we do have a growing and improving track record on public participation.
We do.
But this is one of the really important times.
And we have a lot of transportation professionals who live and work in this region who use our services, who may have ideas from other places. I just think we should not ignore that.
So if you can ask Lynn to kind of think this through and say, when could we get this started? Because the sooner we get it started, the sooner we'll learn something from it. Mr. Golden, you had a question on capital. Are we ready to go to capital?
No, still not.
No, okay. Back to you on operating.
I wanted to just ask some questions about one of the thoughts you put out there, and that was the idea of increasing the rail headways,
yes,
where you indicate that the savings there could be in the range of $24 million in this budget. And I'm trying to understand how you save $24 million, because obviously you're not getting rid of rail cars. The rails are there. You're not getting rid of any station managers because all the stations have to be manned. So I'm asking, trying to understand, you know, pursuing just the credibility of this proposal as to where the savings are that amount to $24 million by increasing the headways by 2 minutes or 3 minutes, depending on the time of day.
The savings mostly comes in the propulsion savings because you're running fewer cars. It also comes in we don't have as many operators now, so it comes in the labor costs of reducing the number of operators that are required, and also while we maintain the rail cars, and we're not using as many parts through the rail cars. So while our labor won't change so much in the CMNT or the shops or anything like that, but we will be using less parts because we have less cars.
So that's
where the bulk of the savings comes from.
Propulsion parts
and then the operators.
I guess that means overtime, personnel overtime is part of the savings.
I'm sorry.
Overtime, you would be reducing amount of overtime?
I don't know so much. There's not a whole lot of overtime. It's simply through, like I said, less operators that we have operating the trains. Less propulsion that we have required to do that, and less parts on those specific trains.
In that connection, though, you sort of offset that by indicating that it would only be a $13 million net, which suggests that you're going to lose $11 million from less riders. And I just want to get a better sense of that, because in other places in the presentation, you point out that there's an inelasticity of transit demand. So I'm trying to understand how, if there is an inelasticity of transit demand, you lose so many riders by extending the headways by a minute or two. Maybe that's something you can look at to see if maybe you've overstated how much the loss of ridership is in something like
that. That would translate to a loss of about 2% of our ridership, and I think it would be in part because you would be losing people in the peak, I think, because they would be experiencing more crowded trains, and I think you would be losing people in the off-peak because you would have widened headways, you know, during the midday and the weekends, you know, in some cases on Sundays, going from 15 to 20 minutes, and some people at the margin would say that's not the way that I want to travel.
And when you lose them in the peak, does that mean they go to the off-peak, or they're lost, or under your theory, are they lost entirely to the
right? Well, that's fair. A few people might decide to change their time of travel, but I think most of them would be lost entirely to a different mode. Again, this is not a huge amount of people. We're talking 2% of the total. But again, you know, you have people who are at the margin, people who have, you know, different choices that they can make. And if they perceive that the service has worsened in quality because of, you know, the passenger loading, some of those folks could make a different decision.
Again, I just urge you to take a hard look at that to see if, you know, that can be adjusted in any way. If that, you know, how
how firm the staff is in believing that that's the offset in terms of lost ridership.
Of course, sure.
The other issue I just wanted to raise, and I apologize, Mr. Chair, for continuing this, but we do have a system where operating expenses are $1.8 billion. Even if 70% represents personnel costs, that still means you've got 30%, or roughly $500 million, $500 million of non-personnel costs, which includes things like the propulsion and energy that Chairman Downs was referring to, as well as advertising, parts, professional service contracts.
$1 million for Metro Access.
You know, I would just encourage you to take a hard look at that $500 million. It strikes me as difficult to believe that one can't really, with a sharp pencil, find another 10 or 20 million in that kind of a pot of money to come back with us, if not to actually recommend, but at least as options that we can consider.
Certainly, and that's, I think, the workshop discussion is a good place to have that discussion.
Yeah.
But again, it's not taking a pencil and just crossing off numbers.
No.
There's an effect with it, and that kind of discussion in a workshop and coming back to the board to make a decision is very appropriate.
Yeah. And as we should do with everything, if it's reduced, what will the impact be? There's nothing in here that would not be, have an impact if it was taken out.
I just want to make one more comment, just echo what Chairman Down said on propulsion. The airlines are going to do very well this year. They're going to have record profits, and they're going to produce record profits because they've priced their fares when crude was priced at $110, $115 a barrel, and it's now down to $75. I mean, it's hard to believe that we can't also take some benefit out of that tremendous decline in the price of crude, at least for FY16. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. But also remember that our competitors of the automobile are also getting an awfully good bargain at $3 gasoline. Yes, Mr. Downs.
Can I make a suggestion? One of the things that customers always tell us back is that they think that they're kind of a second thought, sometimes a last thought, about how we fix problems here. A customer impact analysis of the proposals that you're making about rail frequency, rail service, they're a blunt force approach to dealing with changes in rail service. Reduce all the frequencies by 2 minutes. There is another way of doing that, and that is an analysis of where you could strategically and tactically make reductions in service that could perhaps come close to the kinds of savings that you're producing with an across-the-board set of reductions. Doing reductions on all of the lines at peak hour is inflicting the maximum possible pain on the customer, and we can't act as if we're insensitive to that in this process. So having a customer service analysis and presenting the board with some options that reflect a perhaps reduction in service, but in a way that minimizes the potential impact to the customer, we have to be able to tell the customers that we've done everything we can to protect their service. This is not a problem that they understand or that they own, that we need to balance a budget, and we're going to do it in part by making their life more miserable for the same price. Yeah,
just let me be clear. We are not proposing to reduce or to increase headways on all the services. What we gave you was an example of, in order to, of an option or an example of, in order to get a significant savings in dollars, this is the magnitude of the kind of service adjustment you would have. But I want to make clear that is not a proposal. But we certainly can do.
We don't have a story to tell then about what we're going to take to a public hearing.
But we certainly can.
Before we get to public hearing, we have to do that.
Through,
exactly.
We've had suggestions from your staff, which we are going to cost, and now be part of the workshop discussions, and that will give you an idea of what those
cost savings might be.
If there's a level of reduction in subsidy, even of the magnitude Mr. Goldman talked about, it won't happen without some significant things.
Right.
We need to identify what those are. We need to identify both the legal and the customer
sure.
impacts of
exactly.
them. And then well, I'm also reminded, I'm not suggesting we go in this direction, but the last time we were in a place like this, the customer said we'd rather have our fare go up.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's really important about having a story going forward that we are paying the maximum amount of attention that we can to the customer impact of the decisions. They're just, the customers expect it. It's how they judge us. And we can't afford any less. And it's not here. It can be part of a presentation. And it, if you can't tell your story, the old saying goes, everybody else will
tell it for you.
Will tell it for you. And I don't, there's not a story here yet that you could sell and take to a public hearing process. And I agree with Mary's suggestion that we need a work session about a number of these issues. And we need it in a time frame, unfortunately, that is facing Christmas and New Year's to be able to make a decision in January for a public hearing docket.
Unless it's the timeline that they give us says we have a little more time
right.
to do that.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we only had. How many surveys have we got now about all of the field?
Yeah. I did
another
note,
survey monkey. Yeah.
I did note in the non-proposal but analysis of the impact, you did not include further cuts on the blue line.
Correct.
Which in effect says at least we've heard some response from some
it
of our customers.
It couldn't have gotten any worse.
If we do anything else, we might as well close it.
Close it, right. Are there questions about the capital budget?
Can I go one last thing?
I had
I wanted
one,
to correct
yes.
what I said about the additional positions about fatigue management and overtime. It's 97 positions, not 51. The savings are $5.1 million. So it's almost 100 positions that are in the budget under fatigue risk management, 75 bus operators, 18 track repairs, and 4 EOC.
Mr. Giancola.
Are we ready for the capital budget comment?
I'm ready.
Okay, good. Page 60 of 72 in the book has a profile from 2016 to 2021 and proposed CIP investment levels. And I think I've asked this question before, and I know part of the answer, but you'll notice the first 2 years show the actuals actually going down by close to $56 million as far as executable. Have we reached a point in our staffing levels and project managers where there is basically a baseline of what we really could expect to accomplish as oversight in our CIP? In other words, is there $810 million a year? Is that going to be really the baseline based on our current staffing? And I noticed there's bumps in 16 and 17, which I assume are for the procurement of the 7,000 series cars. And that makes it bump up because it's not really a project per se, it's a procurement. But I mean, is there some more realistic numbers here where we can start looking at least in the capital budget, of what's more practical? In other words, if you look at 13 and 14 in the actual, well, what were the projections at or what were the budget numbers at the time? You know, how much under the budget did we come? And are we kind of overestimating what we can accomplish through overachievement and all those years in the out years? Is there more of a gradual flow or raise or rise in the and the execution rate? And I'm just thinking that I think there probably is, recognizing the bump-ups in 2016 and 2017 need to be factored out. But I just think it may be overestimating our capabilities to say in fiscal 2018 that we're going to hit the billion-dollar mark in executable projects. So I think we need to kind of look at that. I don't need an answer today, but it just seems to me we're over trying to overachieve here, and maybe we can't really achieve what we're putting down this list.
So deliverability is really a key issue. I think it would be useful as well to go back to the starting point of our last CIP, the original capital funding agreement from 5 years ago, and say how well did we do on delivering that. shouldn't ask for money that we can't spend. Yeah. Tom, did you have another question?
Well, it's a 30,000 feet one. Is that okay, Mr.
Sure.
I'm concerned about headway reductions and in the face of lower gas prices. $250 a month to park your daycare, your car. Okay, and I think we're going potentially into a different space here with respect to people abandoning the train or the bus and hopping and, you know, and I think we're already seeing it. So I'm really worried, guys and fellows, about, you know, whether that's factoring into your methodologies about, you know, whether we can go to, you know, George Mason University or wherever you go to find out, you know, what the lower gasoline prices are doing. But I'm already, you know, you're already starting to see it. The Thanksgiving highest ever drivers since 2010. And I think, you know, those trends are, we need to have that factored in such a way that we realize that you know, cutting service may be, you know, cutting our throat to some degree in the face of other economic factors. You know, just stories in the newspaper, you know, more people, you know, families getting more disposable income because, you know, a tank of gas is $20 less than it was, last June. So I think that those few factors are, you know, kind of playing on my mind about what ridership's going to be looking like, and we don't have any control over that. I mean, OPEC said they're not going to stop pumping, so I just want to see if we can factor those kind of trend lines into some of our deliberations. Thank you.
Thank you. Good news is we have to pay less to fill up our buses with fuel, and the bad news is nobody will be riding them.
Hope must be waiting for an endurance.
I had two quick questions on the capital budget, one to understand. You refer in there to $590 million long-term debt. But I read that to include, that's inclusive of what we were going to talk about this time. So it's not 590 to fund the next six-year program. It's 590 over a longer period of time.
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay.
And that's also inclusive of the item that was pulled earlier today. Mm-hmm. So it's the net incremental impact is much less than that.
The other question I had was on the asset management plans that you're developing. As you get a couple of those in place, I think it'd be good to brief the committee on how they were put together and what they mean in terms of decisions going down the road on asset replacement and condition. And I had no other questions. Anyone else on capital budget? Any other business to come before the committee? Which?
Moving this up.
Yeah, we'll work on the staff to get this, to get it done in time for us to have an impact on it. If not, we'll adjourn the meeting.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.